You know that feeling when you're sitting in just dead stop gridlock on the 405?
Oh, yeah, the absolute worst.
Right. Or, you're staring at a rent bill that genuinely looks like a typo. And you just think, who on earth designed this
It
mess?
feels like a massive, chaotic accident.
Exactly. Like the city just organically grew completely out of control.
Yeah.
But it turns out there's actually a mathematical ledger proving that none of this was an accident.
Right. It was all by design.
Every traffic jam, every housing crisis, every missing train line, it was all a deliberate, predictable choice. So today we're taking a deep dive into a shortcut to understand exactly why modern cities, specifically Los Angeles, look and function the way they do.
It's such a fascinating
It
topic.
really is. We are digging into this 2026 policy study called the Los Angeles Externality Atlas. And what this study does is it treats city history not as a series of oops moments, but as this literal catalog of calculated trade-offs.
Yeah, it completely reframes urban history. I mean, the Atlas introduces this very specific framework for looking at these choices by categorizing them through externalities.
Right.
And in economics jargon, an externality is just the side effect of a decision, right? So you build a factory, the intended effect is making shoes.
Right, and you get shares.
Exactly. But the negative externality is like the smoke blowing into the neighborhood next door.
Got it.
But the Atlas ignores the accidental side effects. It focuses entirely on what they call type E externalities.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit. Because if an externality is just a side effect, what actually elevates it to type E?
So a type E externality is one that was entirely predictable at the time the decision was made, but the policymakers just pushed forward anyway.
Wait, so they knew.
Yes, these are not unforeseeable disasters. They aren't the result of like sudden technological shifts no one could have guessed.
Right.
These are negative consequences that leaders either explicitly knew about or statistically should have known about, but they basically accepted them as the necessary price of doing business to get what they wanted in the short term.
Wow. So it's basically like reading the nutritional label on a city policy, realizing the ingredients are toxic, and then discovering the chef wrote down exactly how toxic they were in their own notes before serving it to the public anyway.
That is a brutally accurate way to look at it. The chef knew, served it, and left the restaurant before the food poisoning set in.
Jeez. Which means whether you are, a policy wonk prepping for a real estate meeting, or you're just someone sitting in that traffic wondering why your neighborhood looks the way it does, this deep dive is going to completely change how you view your surroundings.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, just a quick heads up before we really get into it. The Atlas touches on some incredibly sensitive historical and political housing decisions.
Yeah, stuff that still sparks heated city council meetings today. Totally. So, our mission here is to remain completely neutral. We're impartially reporting exactly what the Atlas Ledger reveals without endorsing any specific political side, right? We're taking a moral stance. We're just reading the math.
And the math is really where this study shines, because it forces us out of those abstract, emotional, historical narratives,
Yeah.
and right into cold, hard algebra.
Right.
But before the Atlas throws equations at you, the authors created this brilliant visual metaphor to explain how a city actually functions. They call it the histological view.
Histological. Okay, like studying human tissue under a microscope in biology class.
Exactly like that. They view the city as living, breathing layers of urban tissue. So at the very top, you have the epidermis.
The skin of the city.
Right. In urban terms, the policy epidermis is made up of rules, zoning ordinances, building codes, and master plans.
Okay, that makes sense.
And below that skin is the dermis, which is the market layer. That's made of capital, rents, and land values. Oh, interesting. So the rules on the surface, the epidermis, literally dictate how the money and value move underneath in the dermis.
Exactly.
Like if you zone a block for high rises, the land value just shoots up.
Spot on. And then you go a layer deeper to the vasculature, the blood vessels.
Okay.
That's your physical infrastructure. So roads, transit lines, water pipes,
Right.
sewers.
The stuff that moves things around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And pumping through all of those vessels is the social tissue, which is the actual households, the human migration, the people.
Got it.
And binding the entire organism together is the cultural tissue. So the memory, the historical landmarks, and just the identity of the city.
I really love that framework. I mean, it makes a sprawling metropolis feel like a single understandable organism.
Yeah, it really does.
But if that is the healthy anatomy of a city, where do these type E externalities fit in.
They are the pathology.
The disease.
Exactly. Type E externalities are the toxins that accumulate across all those layers over decades. And it's all because of bad rules implemented at the epidermis level.
Wow.
And the Atlas doesn't just guess at how toxic a policy was. They calculate it using a formula called the EPI, the Externality Predictability Index.
Right, here comes the algebra. Break down the EPI formula for us. How do you actually mathematically score a historical mistake?
So the EPI is calculated by multiplying four specific variables together.
Okay.
It's M times K times T times S.
Okay, let me write this down. M, K, T, S, what do they stand for?
So M stands for mechanism clarity, basically how obvious the cause and effect was.
Okay.
K is prior knowledge, like what the scientific literature or historical record explicitly said at the time.
Got it.
T is time to effect, how long it takes for the consequence to actually become visible.
Right. Yeah.
And S is statistical observability, how easily we can measure it in hard data, like building permits or tax revenue.
Okay, let me make sure I'm wrapping my head around this. Let's step outside of city planning for just a second.
Sure.
If, say, a tech company rushes a new phone to market, and the engineers literally send an email saying, you know, the battery will catch fire if it gets too hot, that K variable, prior knowledge, is sky high.
Extremely high.
Yep. And the mechanism, M, is clear. Heat equals fire. So if they sell it anyway, that is a high EPI score. It's a highly predictable pathology.
That is the exact logic. Yeah. Now, you just apply that to a zoning law or a transit project.
But, and here's where I really have to push back a bit.
Yeah.
I get the phone analogy because you have an email.
Right.
But how can researchers in 2026 possibly prove what a city council member in, say, 1913 or even 1980 actually knew? I mean, we have a century of hindsight, data modeling, sociological research that they just didn't have. So isn't scoring their decisions just kind of historical fan fiction?
That skepticism is totally fair, and it's exactly why the M variable, the source record confidence tier, is the anchor of the entire formula.
Okay.
The Atlas authors anticipated that exact criticism, so they strictly filter out hindsight.
Really?
They only rely on documented historical records, census data, mapped records, and prior knowledge that was verifiably available and presented at the time the decision was made.
Oh, wow. So they're looking at the actual meeting minutes, the engineering reports from the era, the letters sent to the mayor?
Yes, exactly. And if the historical record is sparse, the M score drops significantly. The Atlas simply admits the outcome was only weakly predictable because the data just wasn't there.
Okay, so it's fair.
Very fair. They never grade an 18th century decision with 21st century science.
Which means if a policy gets a high EPI score in this Atlas, the classic political defense of, you know, well, nobody could have possibly known this would happen, that completely falls apart.
Oh, it crumbles.
The math proves the data was sitting right on their desk.
Yeah. The ledger removes the excuse of ignorance completely.
Wow. Okay, so having established how this tissue works and how we measure the toxins, let's actually trace this pathology chronologically.
Let's do it.
Let's look at the epidermis, the earliest rules that laid the foundation for modern Los Angeles. The Atlas starts way back with the founding of the Pueblo by the Spanish colonial administration in 1781.
Right. So the Spanish colonial leaders wanted a defensible settlement near the Los Angeles River. That was their intended benefit.
Makes sense.
But the negative externality was pathlocking the future city into a floodplain and establishing an aggressive water rights regime that ended up displacing the indigenous Tongva people.
But applying our formula, I mean, they didn't have computer simulated flood risk models in 1781.
No, of course not, which is why the Atlas gives this era a very low EPI score. It's just a 0.04.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's weakly predictable based on the sparse anecdotal data of the era. The mechanism just wasn't clearly mapped.
Okay, but the pathology gets a lot more deliberate as we move into the 20th century, right? I mean, by 1908, Los Angeles passes the very first land use zoning ordinance in the United States.
Yeah, this is a major pivot point in the city's DNA. The 1908 ordinance mapped out specific industrial districts. The goal was to separate noxious, polluting industries from residential pockets.
Which honestly sounds like incredible governance. I mean, nobody wants to live next door to a slaughterhouse or a chemical plant. You want to separate those things.
Right. Nuisance reduction was absolutely the intended benefit. But the Type E externality was profound.
How so?
Well, by creating the legal scaffold to explicitly separate uses of land, they built the exact machinery that would later be weaponized for exclusion.
Ah.
The moment you normalize separating a factory from a house, it is a very short legal leap to separating an apartment building from a single family house.
Oh, man. And if you zone out apartment buildings, and you know that marginalized groups or working class families predominantly rely on apartments.
Exactly.
You have effectively zoned out those groups without ever explicitly mentioning race or class in the law itself.
Right. And that leads directly into the 1920s, which the Atlas identifies as a high confidence, highly predictable era of pathology.
The Roaring Twenties.
Yeah. This is when single family districting really takes hold, paired with restrictive covenants.
Right.
Subdividers and homeowner associations began attaching legal clauses to property deeds that explicitly excluded Black, Latino, Asian, and Jewish households from owning or renting in the majority of the city's new developments.
And the Atlas notes, these covenants were legally enforced by the courts for decades, right?
Yeah.
All the way until the Shelley v. Kramer Supreme Court decision in 1948.
They were. The intended benefit here was protecting property values for white homeowners and creating stable, homogeneous neighborhoods.
Okay.
But the predictable externality was the intentional hardening of the racial wealth gap. By removing roughly two-thirds of the city from multifamily housing eligibility, they engineered artificial scarcity.
Now, you mentioned the K variable earlier, prior knowledge. Urban policy followers already know about redlining and covenants. Like, that history is really well documented.
Right. It's not a secret.
But what is fascinating here is how the Atlas actually scores it.
Yeah.
How do we know they understood the long-term economic damage of this rather than just acting on the, you know, the prejudices of the time?
So the documentary evidence shows that housing advocates, minority journalists, and even certain economic planners at the time were actively publishing data.
Really?
Yeah. Data showing that restricting housing supply in amenity-rich areas was creating severe overcrowding and suppressing wealth generation in redline districts.
Oh, wow.
So the policy epidermis was fully aware it was starving the social tissue, but they prioritized the dermis, the property values of the incumbents.
That is wild.
Hmm.
But this raises a massive question for me. It is so easy to look back with a red pen and circle everything they did wrong.
True.
But does the Atlas actually prove there was a realistic, better way? Or are they just pointing fingers from the future?
This is one of the smartest methodological choices in the study, actually. The Atlas operates under a strict counterfactual rule.
What does that mean?
They refuse to render fantasy scenarios. There is no model in the study asking, you know, what if Los Angeles became Paris?
Right. Because importing a European layout into Southern California in the 1920s is just an entirely useless thought experiment.
Completely useless. They only run the math on evidence-backed alternatives that were actually proposed or legally feasible at the time.
Okay, so what was the alternative for the 1920s?
For the 1920s, the evidence-backed alternative was a race-neutral, form-based code.
Form-based code, okay.
Yeah, this would have permitted low-rise, multifamily, housing-like duplexes and courtyard apartments citywide, paired with voiding those restrictive covenants.
And what does the math say that would have done?
The mathematical model shows this alternative would have completely altered the social tissue. It would have absorbed the massive population growth without creating the extreme engineered land scarcity that really defines LA today.
It is genuinely chilling to think how different the city's DNA would be if they had just pulled that alternative lever.
It really is.
But they didn't.
Yeah.
And as we move chronologically past World War II, the damage moves from the rules of the epidermis, like deep into the physical vasculature of the city.
Right.
We enter the bulldozer era.
Ah, yes. The physical reshaping of the city from the late 1940s through the 1960s was dominated by massive infrastructure projects, most notably the freeway build-out.
Right.
The intended benefit was regional mobility, connecting the booming post-war suburbs to the urban core. The positive spillover was faster commerce and better integration with the shipping ports.
But you cannot build a massive concrete highway through an already populated city without knocking down whatever's in front of you.
Exactly. And that is the brutal Type E externality. The freeways were intentionally routed through dense, predominantly Black and Latino neighborhoods like Boyle Heights and Sugar Hill.
Again, we know freeways displace people. We've heard that.
Yeah.
But what is the Atlas's mechanism score here? Like, did the engineers just draw a straight line on a map and hit these neighborhoods by accident?
No, and this is where it gets dark. The specific routing documents, the K variable, reveal that alternative routes, including preserving parts of the Pacific Electric Rail network or routing highways around dense areas, were actively evaluated and dismissed.
Wait, dismissed why?
The highway engineers specifically noted the lower property values and a lack of political capital in these marginalized neighborhoods.
You're kidding.
No. They calculated that bulldozing 10,000 households in Boyle Heights would generate less political friction than disturbing wealthier, whiter enclaves. The burden of displacement and future air quality impacts was intentionally placed on these communities to benefit suburban commuters.
They literally had the train route and the bulldozer route on the table, and they chose the bulldozer because the people in its path just didn't have the political leverage to stop it.
That's exactly what the ledger shows.
That is heartbreaking. And once those freeways carved up those neighborhoods, the city essentially had a blueprint for targeting the exact same communities for its next massive project, urban renewal.
Right. The slum clearance era of the 1950s and 60s operates on the exact same logic. City leaders wanted a modernized, glittering downtown, so they utilized eminent domain to erase dense, affordable housing stock.
The most famous example in the Atlas being Chavez Ravine, which is where Dodger Stadium sits today.
Yes. They displaced the residents of vibrant communities like Palo Verde, La Loma, and Bishop under the promise of building better public housing.
But they didn't build it.
No, that housing was never fully delivered. The replacement sports stadiums and commercial towers drastically underhoused the prior residents. The predictable cost of this displacement was entirely externalized onto the poorest tenants who had basically no legal standing to fight back.
It is just a compounding series of choices, prioritizing the people with power over the people in the way.
Exactly.
But then, as we hit the late 1970s, the pathology shifts again. We aren't really talking about physical bulldozers anymore. We're talking about a fiscal lock. Proposition 13 in 1978.
Yeah, this is one of the most consequential policy shifts on the entire ledger. Proposition 13 was a statewide ballot initiative intended to provide property tax relief.
Because inflation was crazy.
Right. In the 1970s, inflation was skyrocketing, and homeowners on fixed incomes were being completely crushed by rising property tax assessments.
And to be fair, that is a very real problem.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't want a retired senior citizen being taxed out of the home they've lived in for 40 years just because the market around them exploded.
No, you don't. And the Atlas mathematically acknowledges that. It actually notes the reduction in involuntary displacement for those senior owners as a positive externality.
Right.
But the type E externality, the predictably massive downside, was that Prop 13 didn't just help seniors. It permanently decoupled property tax from market value for everyone, including massive commercial properties.
Wait, I want to make sure I understand the mechanism here, because this is where the math gets totally wild. Prop 13 is basically like freezing your personal credit card bill at 1975 levels.
Okay, I like this analogy.
Right. So no matter how much you spend today, you only pay the 1975 price. But the credit card company still needs their money, so they force your kids and your brand new neighbors to pay the difference for all the city's services forever.
That is exactly it.
And the Atlas points out that places like Disneyland are still paying taxes based on assessments from decades ago.
Yes, that analogy is spot on. And the mechanism of how this poisoned the city's zoning is fascinating. Because local governments could no longer rely on property taxes to fund essential services like schools, roads, and fire departments, it created a massive municipal budget crisis.
Oh, because if I build a new apartment building, I'm bringing in new residents. Those residents need schools, they cause wear and tear on the roads. But if property taxes are functionally frozen, the city literally can't afford to provide those services.
Precisely, which is why cities were forced into what planners call the fiscalization of land use.
The fiscalization of land use.
Yeah. Local governments desperately needed money, and the only reliable source left was sales tax. So they literally had to start zoning for auto malls, big box retailers, and strip malls instead of housing.
Right, because an auto mall doesn't send kids to the local school district.
Exactly. But it generates massive sales tax to keep the city's lights on.
So a tax law passed to help seniors literally mutated the physical layout of the city, replacing neighborhoods with car dealerships just to avoid bankruptcy.
That's exactly what happened.
Which brings our timeline right up to the modern era, from the 1980s to 2026. And this is where the Atlas points out this glaring asymmetry in the data. 8 out of the 11 major pathology nodes they catalog directly bottleneck the housing supply.
Yeah, the historical lack of housing supply from those earlier zoning nodes created this sort of localized panic. Residents felt the squeeze of growth, and that panic led to the modern era, which the Atlas defines by the weaponization of environmental and neighborhood protections.
And the clearest example of this is Proposition U in 1986.
Yes. The Atlas says this specific policy has the highest EPI, the highest predictability score in the entire catalog at 0.58.
Wow.
The mechanics were undeniable and the data was everywhere. Prop U was a ballot measure driven by homeowner federations who were reacting to the commercial growth of the mid-80s.
They were feeling that squeeze.
Right. They wanted to protect their single-family neighborhoods from increased traffic and taller buildings. So Prop U literally halved the allowable commercial floor area on the vast majority of the city's transit corridors.
They just took a magic eraser and deleted half the potential airspace for businesses and apartments overnight.
Pretty much.
It killed the concept of a walkable 15-minute city before the term even existed.
Yeah, the positive externality was a stable, low-scale corridor for the adjoining homeowners. But the predictable downside was a massive permanent sacrifice of tax bases, transit viability, and renter opportunity.
Okay, here's where I have to challenge the entire premise of human behavior, though.
Okay, let's hear it.
The Atlas calculates the net present value for Prop U, the actual annual net cost to the city of Los Angeles. They calculate it at -$0.95 billion a year.
Yeah, it's staggering.
Almost $1 billion of lost value annually. If the math is that objectively bad, why on earth does the city vote for it and keep voting for similar restrictions?
Right.
I mean, are we just gluttons for punishment?
This is perhaps the most profound insight in the entire study. The researchers use a game theory payoff matrix to explain this behavior. They call it the dominant trap.
The dominant trap. Okay, let's walk through that matrix. How does it actually work?
So when a city chooses to restrict growth, whether through Prop U or through the weaponization of the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA, which we see heavily in the 90s and 2000s, the benefits of that restriction are highly concentrated.
Okay.
The incumbents, meaning the homeowners already living in the neighborhood, get immediate, highly visible benefits.
Right. If I vote yes on restricting development, my street stays quiet, my view of the hills is preserved, and because supply is restricted, the value of my home artificially skyrockets. It's basically a localized monopoly.
Exactly. Yeah. But the billion-dollar bill still has to be paid. The trap is that the costs of that restriction are diffuse and invisible.
So who pays it?
The price is paid by future renters who face exorbitant prices, by small businesses that can never afford to open, by non-residents who are forced into two-hour commutes, and ultimately by unhoused populations who just fall out of the bottom of the market entirely.
And if I am reading the matrix right, the cruelest part of the dominant track is the voting power.
Yes.
The people receiving all those concentrated benefits,
yeah,
the incumbents, are the ones actually showing up to the Tuesday morning zoning hearings. The people absorbing the diffuse costs don't even have a vote because they don't live in the jurisdiction yet,
yeah,
or they're working three jobs to pay the rent and just can't attend a city council meeting.
You nailed it. The system is mathematically rigged to favor the person already holding the keys, and we see this vividly with CEQA.
Right, the Environmental Act.
Yeah. A law genuinely designed to protect rivers and air quality from industrial pollution was slowly repurposed by incumbents. They use its endless veto points and the threat of anonymous litigation to block apartment buildings next to train stations.
Which is crazy because that is the most environmentally friendly housing you can build.
Exactly. It is weaponized friction. Even when we look at the final node in the Atlas, which covers the recent era up to 2026, this includes reforms meant to streamline affordable housing.
Like the TOC and ED1 reforms, right?
Right. The Atlas notes these are positive corrections generating documented increases in housing units, but they are still facing massive uneven litigation friction because those veto layers from the incumbent era are just deeply entrenched in the epidermis of the city.
Wow. It is like trying to cure the pathology in the tissue,
mm-hmm,
but the patient's own immune system is actively fighting off the medicine.
Because the patient, the incumbent homeowner, feels perfectly fine. It is the rest of the body that is starving.
Man, this has been an incredible journey. We have moved from a Spanish colonial settlement in a floodplain in 1781 to a sprawling, gridlocked metropolis in 2026.
It's a lot of history.
It really is. We've traveled right through the epidermis of zoning rules, past the dermis of capital, down to the pathological accumulation of predictable externalities in our physical streets. And what this Atlas really proves is that whether you are staring at LA traffic, sky-high rents, or a delayed transit project anywhere in the world, you are not looking at a mistake. you're looking at a mathematical ledger coming due.
Absolutely. And, you know, if we connect all of this to the bigger picture, it raises a very uncomfortable reality for anyone who cares about cities.
What's that?
The Atlas proves that the most damaging urban policies don't happen because our leaders are blind. And they don't happen by accident. They happen because human nature reliably prioritizes the comfort of the incumbent, the person already inside the system, the person who already has theirs.
Right.
The math shows exactly what happens when a society continually chooses exclusion to protect its own backyard.
And that is the exact thought I want to leave you with today. Look at your own neighborhood, your own city council, your own property. When you vote for stability or neighborhood character today, what type E externality are you quietly agreeing to pass on to the next generation? When do you become the incumbent?
That's the real question.
Thanks so much for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. Because understanding the math of our past is the only way we are ever going to redraw the map of our future. Until next time.